Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And Criminal Minds is over. Just you don't know this because this is airing 6 months after we record it, but we haven't recorded anything really since the end of Criminal Minds. And it's still kind of weird for us now that Criminal Minds is over. And everything we talk about now is going to have is going to be, to a certain extent, colored by the fact that we know the way the show ends.
Yes.
And, let's just say how it ends.
Well, we're not going to necessarily... We're going to try hard not to let it affect what we were going to say, but we will have addendums all the time.
Oh, are we ever.
We will.
It's going to come up. Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's going to come up. All right. But yes, before we get there, we do have a lot of other stuff to cover, which is why we're going to start with...
The Bond. When two people are blitz attacked, stabbed to death, and posed post-mortem at different truck stop restrooms throughout the South, the BAU coordinates with the Atlanta field office to identify a killer acting on orders from someone determined to exact revenge against the people who wronged them.
Yeah. Okay. The premise of this one is, I mean, you saw the Eileen Wuornos movie, right?
Actually, no.
Oh, you didn't see the movie?
Nope.
It's pretty good. Much better of it than it is Nick Broomfield's documentary, Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer, which is a documentary he made about the media and serial killers and the narrative that needs to be told. It actually, if you like Criminal Minds, it's a really good documentary to check out. Just something to think about. But yes, so this is obviously what if Eileen Wuornos had a son. That's the plot of this episode. They're not shy about it, you know?
No, and they actually make her look kind of...
Yeah, they even make her look a little like that, you know?
Well, sort of the discrepitudes.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Excuse me. It's an interesting episode in a couple of ways because it's a little frustrating. Because right away, you get the whole, just yet another guy who goes off his meds and start killing people. Yeah.
Well, we don't know that he went off his meds for a while.
No, but we learned that, you're right, halfway through that he stopped taking his medication. But it's like, yeah, it's very strange because we don't really learn enough about this guy to understand why he's so obsessed with his mother. And even in the end, where we find out that she made him stab his dad, I'm like, is that enough really to get you to have this kind of level of obsession?
With your mother? Yeah, the other thing that I wasn't too keen on, and it struck me even more the second time I watched it, was that he was doing a Brad Dourif.
It's very similar, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm sure it was deliberate, but I don't know.
You watch it and you get that energy and you're like, ooh, I've seen this kind of thing before, and I've seen it better elsewhere.
Well, no, it's even his voice and his mannerisms, right?
Yeah, he's definitely trying to get that voice and mannerisms, energy, and the the roiling just below the surface of a Brad Dourif role. Yeah, he's definitely inspired by that kind of performance that Brad Dourif did.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, no, I completely agree with that. And he's not bad. I'm not complaining about him or his mother,
he was very good.
It's very obvious what's happening. But I had a couple of problems with the episode, more than a few, actually, because I got so confused watching this episode simply because I don't understand how they caught this woman. Right?
In the first place. Yeah.
Because we find out, right, that because they have the most ludicrous jump to a conclusion about how they find the killer in ages and ages and ages. Which is, they're like, they say, why did you stop killing men? And she's like, because I got caught. No, I think you specifically stop killing men because you had successfully murdered the man who raped you, your son's father, and now you were done killing, and that's why you were hiding out in that barn, and his body is definitely still in that barn, and we can go there to find your son. And you watch that, and you're like, okay. What are they basing that on?
We're not too sure.
What are you basing that logic on? Because, and this is the key part, and they don't get into how she was caught at all, and it really bothers me, because all we learn is that she had killed a bunch of men.
Right? Even if she was waiting in the barn, how did they know to go to the barn?
Well, no, and that's where we get weird, yeah. Because they weren't looking for, as far as I can tell, they weren't looking for her for serial killing. They were looking for her because the government,
her child away?
Yeah, the government grabbed her child because she was neglecting and abusing him.
Okay.
And they took the child away and she kidnapped the kid back and she went and hid out in a barn with the kid. And what confused me when I was watching it was, okay, well, how did they then, like, how did they connect her to this, like, also she was serial killing, right?
Yeah, so how did they connect her to the serial killer?
Yeah, that's what I'm
asking. Unless she told them, or unless the boy told them.
But if the boy had told him, I feel like it would be in his record somewhere that, oh yeah, there was that whole scene where he stabbed his own dad. You know, I feel like that would have come up.
Yeah, but, you know, this is Minds.
It's Criminal Minds, so maybe not. Yeah, although now I'm flashing back to Mindhunter, of all things, with that the guy's motivation being that, yeah, they never thought for a second I could have killed my parents. Huh?
Huh?
So yeah, like maybe they wouldn't have interviewed the kid about that. That is possible. They would have just not thought about it at all. But I find the idea crazy that it's like, so they find her out there, and they arrest her, and they know she's serial killing, but they didn't search the barn at all, because that guy was not deeply buried.
No.
So it's like, he had been freshly murdered when she was caught, so it's like, why didn't they find this out about them way back then? And I would suggest that this guy, secretly, this serial killer, might have had, like, a possible career as the best private investigator in the world, because one of the people she wanted revenge on was homeless now.
Yeah.
And he managed to track that guy down with no trouble at all. He found a random homeless man for his revenge. How did you find that
picked
guy?
Picked him up in the middle of the pouring rain.
Yeah, picked him up in the middle of the pouring rain. Like, you managed to find this guy and pick him up and bring him to... How? How did you do that? Oh, man. But I think at the core, like, psychologically speaking, while psychology doesn't help them catch him at all, right? Like, psychologically speaking, I guess I kind of get it's the folie à deux thing, where it's like, she had so abused him as a child that he felt like he had no identity without her, so when she came back into his life, or he, you know, got her back into his life, then, like, he had no choice but to go along with it, I think is what they're going for.
Yeah, I think that's what they're going, well, because, of course, the child never got any therapy, so.
Yeah, no, obviously.
We have to assume this.
Completely.
Okay, so the child, well, no, the minute that he came back, he went looking for his mother because he always felt there was the hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And of course he would have been supported by this. But the minute he found out she was in the jail for the criminally insane, then maybe he should have backed off. But it's
right.
That, which is what his fiance says.
Yeah.
You know, the minute he met his mother, he stopped taking his meds. You don't need your meds, dear.
I know.
But she would have, because she, well, first of all, she hated him.
Yep.
Okay, because he was the product of this horrible rape that she couldn't cope with and get over.
Yep.
And then became obsessed with finding the guy that did it, the trucker that did it.
Killing truckers over and over again until she got the right one.
Yeah, but why? You know, anyway, never mind. That's
well,
that's,
I mean, that goes into the psychology of the real Eileen Wuornos.
Yeah, right? But still, yeah, you know,
you are
this
right.
is not an Eileen Wuornos reference.
Story. Yeah, so we can't, you're right, we can't use what we know about the real killer to factor in this character's
explain.
Actions. Yeah, no, you're absolutely and, right. It's not fair of me to do that.
You know, I mean, why didn't she just go haunting truck stops until she found the guy and then killed him?
Yeah, why did she go? Because, yeah, I mean, I guess I mean, we have to assume
I
that...
I have no rationale for her killing all of these other men.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we have to go get into the assumption that, again, like the real woman, she, like the real killer, she also had a lifetime of abuse leading up to, you know, her becoming a serial killer. Because Eileen Wuornos, of course, the real woman, I know... They're so off. I think they're trying to draft on the real woman's story here.
So much.
So there is, yeah, there, because they don't establish her character really much
at all,
anywhere near as much as they would need to. But I think the idea is she was like sexually assaulted from the time she was a child, right? And the only work she could find was as a prostitute for truckers, right? And she continued being assaulted by these men who just treated her as an object, and eventually she started lashing out at them. That's the real story, right? And so you, but you're right, for this one, by trying to say that her violence was triggered specifically by a pregnancy, right?
By the rape?
By the rape and
the
pregnancy.
Subsequent pregnancy.
Yeah, like that is specifically...
And that turned her into this horrible serial killer.
Rather than a lifetime of abuse having turned into the serial killer, which is, of course, the far more likely cause.
Well, yeah, that except that it still wouldn't. If she was a prostitute... Oh, never mind. I'm not gonna yeah, go there. But the thing is that she would have raised her son, you know, to be so dependent on her. I mean, they were, of course, in the school system, definitely questioning her ability to have the child.
Yeah.
Right? And because she wasn't, so the child is has got a complete, we would call this a fully realized borderline disorder. He has absolutely no idea who he is without his mother.
There's no separation in his, he has no sense of identity between himself and his mother.
Except that he did, as long as, except he always felt there was a hole, but he still did manage to carve out a decent life for himself.
Yeah, and that's the weird, and I think that's the weirdest part about the episode. Apparently this guy is like, has a fully complete, satisfying, and together life. And as you say, he meets his mother once, and she gets him to stop taking his meds. Like, that's kind of abrupt there, dude.
Yeah, except that, she, probably, you know, probably had all sorts of things to just, you know, trigger him. You know, and because she
and
would have,
control him.
She would have been, she would have just put him right back into being a child, and she would have started to get him to do things because that's what she did. For God's sake, she got him to help kill his father.
Yeah. No, and he had always been completely dependent. And you're right. I mean, they do establish that the kid has always been completely dependent on this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They do establish that well in the episode. So it's like,
yeah.
But yeah, to immediately stop taking his meds. Yeah, and that's actually kind of a dark thing in the episode, because it suggests that no matter how well you get your life together, you're only like one rough conversation with your awful mother away from becoming a serial killer.
Well, the thing is that it's because they put him on meds.
Yeah.
Right?
Instead
Rather
of getting
than
him the therapy.
Really dealing with what's wrong, okay, the meds will just take care of it. And the meds do take care of it, except that it doesn't resolve any of the things.
Underlying
the
issues.
The underlying
minute you stop
issues.
Taking it. Yeah.
Because
he's taking
they knew
the meds that balance him out.
Was.
Oh, yeah.
His
and you're right.
Insane.
She was a serial
she
killer.
She was a serial killer. Why the hell isn't this child getting some level?
Well, it's, you know, I hate to say it, but it's the South.
It was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was 30 years ago. It was the South. They don't have a ton of social services available to him. That's just a fact. I mean, it's unpleasant to say, but it's 100% true that this guy would not have had a lot of social services available to him.
No, but I mean, the thing is, but even, you know, you could figure that people...
Someone would have... And I like that we want to naively say that it's like someone would have understood that it's like only bad consequences can happen from letting this kid just essentially be on his own after this horrific thing with his mother. But then again, what do we know about the foster care system?
Well, yeah, you know, they put him in foster care, so that can't have been any better.
No, no. In fact, I'm sure like it only made his issues considerably worse. So, yeah, like. The more we talk about it, the more I realize that there's actually a bunch of realism to this episode.
Yeah, yeah, there is.
There really is.
Because he was just, he just didn't know who he was. And his mother, who, yeah, I mean, who had already him so gotten him to kill somebody, well.
Yeah, it was easy enough to move, to get him back there.
For her to get, she had manipulated him. And then that end scene where he cuts off his ear so he'll be more like his mother.
Yeah, that was creepy.
Further sort of that. Doing the merge. I mean, this is a child. I mean, this is an extreme case. Right?
Of him having no identity. It is.
No,
because, you know,
by
age 2, 3, you're supposed to understand that you're a separate person than your mother. Uh-huh. And this kid, as you point out, never got there. And they never buried it with drugs, but he never got there.
No. So the minute he finally contacts his mother again.
Yeah, he gets pulled right back into it. And yeah, you know, now the more, I gotta say, psychologically speaking, it really does factor into it. I mean, again, psychology has, like, there is a psychological grounding to this episode. The more we talk about, the more I appreciate. But again, that had nothing to do with how they caught them. They just looked at what the victims had in common.
Mm-hmm.
They had both worked on taking away a serial killer's child.
Yeah,
that's probably why they're getting serial killed now.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, we can make a direct line from A to B here.
I know, right?
We don't even need C, D, or E. It's A, B.
Yeah, oh yeah, it turns out they had both worked to take away the child from a serial killer. All three of them. Oh, okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I think you're right that it's psychologically very well grounded, like, the narrative of the villain. And as I said, I want to say I don't believe it. But the more I think about development, like how kids' development works when they're abused this way, and how the foster care system, as you say, gives you drugs instead of treating you, then yeah, there's a real sense that this is one of their more psychologically well-observed episodes this season.
And because he would have mirrored, you see, the thing is that, you know, I mean, with this kind of a borderline disorder, that's all I can call it, you know, because it's not kind of it's not dissociation. He is seriously identified himself. He doesn't know where he and his mother end, like where his mother ends and he begins. There is no such thing for him, but he would have had to then, when his mother is in jail, and of course he's not taken to see her. He's never told where she is.
Yeah,
because he has to go looking for her.
Yeah, because it's an out of sight, out of mind type of situation. They figure
he has to create some external rationale to create a human being for himself, and he does. And he was probably after that quite good in school, and he probably was quite good socially, and
he seems to have a completely together life.
Well, he can pick up cues and the rest of it. I mean, that's one of the things with severely abused children. If there's one thing they know how to do, it is
read people
and know what's expected of them.
Yep.
Pretty quickly and adjust and adapt. And he seems to have a good job. I mean, look at where they're living.
Yeah.
He's getting married. Everything is just fine. He just has to keep taking these meds or he has these horrible dreams.
Yeah. And that is what the mother and that hole at the core of his personality that he never dealt with. That's what his mother is able to exploit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting episode. The more I think about it. All right. Let's move on to our second one. Hostage, which should be called Hostages. They forgot that there were two of them.
There was more than...
No, the hostages are the little girls at the end. They're who, like, the girls, there's the girls he's torturing.
Okay, well,
torturing.
Let me read this.
Yeah, read the synopsis.
When a missing St. Louis, Missouri foster child leads local authorities to a house where she claims to have been held against her will with two other girls, the BAU juggles identifying her abductor, rescuing her fellow captives, and getting through to the girl who depends on him the most. This is a badly written sentence.
Yeah. And it's, again, not juggling. Those are the steps they take to solve the crime.
Yes. Not plus, juggling. It doesn't even refer to the two daughters.
Yeah, it doesn't mention, but I mean, I guess they want that to be a surprise. So, the hostages are the daughters, and he keeps the hostages there as a way to guarantee good behavior from the lead girl, Violet, right? To keep her on side and keep her obeying him. She knows that if she disobeys him, she'll never get to see the daughters.
Yeah, her sisters again.
Quote-unquote sisters, yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. So it's a gross episode.
Oh, it was a really gross. Well, yeah, but it's the same thing as what's her face being Derek's sister.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Keep the child the away,
culture.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And keep that's how you hold
hostage
them.
In the slave culture. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Except this girl who was taken when she was like
eight,
six or eight. Thank
she
you.
Was
yeah,
eight.
I was gonna say six or seven, but yeah, taken when she was eight, she had a much worse sense of how the world works.
Oh, obviously. Yeah, she had no idea.
Yeah, because she had been... I mean, and this is, of course, they mention Ariel Castro, but this actually happens more often than is good to think about. There are any number. I think the most direct version of this one, in fact, is not the Ariel Castro story, but that woman who was kidnapped when she was, like, eight and locked away for 15 years in a series of sheds in a guy's backyard where she had kids. And it was just, ugh. The movie Room was based on that.
Yeah.
That was such a good movie, but so upsetting to watch. But the point is, it's a very upsetting episode. I think that's where I would like to start, is it's very gross. It's very hard to watch. And it's like, it has to be. Like, there's no way to tell this story well. But even though I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, and I understand that they're telling the story they're trying to tell, there is a part of this episode that pissed me off to no end. And can you guess what that is, or should I just tell you?
Oh, no. Why don't you just tell
us? I'll just tell you. It's fine. I'll just tell you. I'm not going to make a big deal. I'm not going to be coy. One of these girls, like, never gives up her core identity, never stops knowing who she is and what she's been through, and that this is wrong. She goes through the most torture. And she goes through the most torture at the hands of this sadistic monster. She always fights to stay sane and remember her own name and do the best she can. And she is the one who breaks out and sets them all free. And then 20 minutes in the episode, they forget that character exists and it's not her story anymore. And the show has zero interest in that character. A frigging hero for the rest of the show. They have no interest in that character. The one who was a foster child, who was, you know, grabbed with a look after this puppy ruse, right? And who has suffered abhorrently. But it's like, no, let's go pay attention to the other victim. You know, let's go pay more attention and talk more about the tragedy of the girl who was taken from a nice family who loved her. That's who we should really be concerned about.
Yeah, because what I was, you see, I mean, and even the second time around, I was still, I even though I knew it wasn't going to happen, I was just going, why can't the girl that died live and then take her her savior home with her?
Well, because then you don't get the ending where she shoots Daniel Roebuck, which is what they really wanted to get to.
Yeah. I know.
Why can't this savior get herself a new family? You know, that's how you want this episode to the end.
That's how I wanted it.
That's
to
how
end.
You need the episode to end.
And I needed it both times I watched it.
And yeah, the first time I watched it, I was sickened by the way they treat this hero. And the second time I'm watching it, I knew it was coming, so it's even worse.
Yeah, I know, it's even worse.
It's even worse the second time, because you know it's coming. That they completely disregard this character, because they're so, you know... And I understand, you need to find these little girls. I get that, okay? Like, I understand the importance of finding these little girls. I get why that's... Like, but the woman here, who's a hero, gets completely disregarded by the story. And the story basically forgets she exists at the end. And that pissed me off so much. And I'm glad you're on the same page with me on this.
Oh, front. Well, and all I could think about, okay, this is what I thought when they had the mother of the girl who died.
Yeah.
I don't know what her name was. Yeah. Anyway, what flower she was. Lily, I think, died.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think you're right, but it's not important.
Anyway, the one who died, right?
Yeah.
So this mother, and all I could think of was, okay, yeah, so the BAU has once again saved the government a lot of money by allowing somebody to kill their...
Yep. Yeah, kill their suspect.
Well, and not only that, you know, but how the hell did she get a gun in the hospital?
I don't know.
This is 2016.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like it's Canada where you can just walk into a hospital. American hospitals have metal detectors. Can't just walk a gun into a hospital in America.
Even a Catholic hospital.
Yeah, that's like, honestly, it's so bizarre. Also, like, I mean, to a certain extent, I don't even know why a lot of these scenes are taking place at the hospital. Like, the whole thing takes place at the hospital.
Because
like,
he didn't have enough money for another
set. For another set. But it's like, I don't know why you're bringing Daniel Roebuck back to a hospital. I don't know why.
Why
like,
he's there a hospital.
Yeah. Like, why is he in a hospital at all? And I think in their head, all of these scenes are taking place at the hospital because they want that shooting to happen at the end. And they think to themselves, well, it'll be easier to buy him getting her getting a gun in if they're in a hospital and not a police station. You know?
Well, he was at the hospital because they broke his arm.
Yeah, but you set his arm and then you drive him to the police station. That's the thing. Like, set his arm and you take him to the police station. There's no reason to spend the rest of the time at the hospital.
Yeah, you can do all of this other stuff at the police station.
Oh, by the way.
But I suspect they were running out of money. It's near the end of the season.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I've got very pragmatic about this show. Okay, this actually has a problem.
I always make my joke about when I'm reviewing the episodes and when I'm watching the episodes a little about how like they always waste a huge amount of law enforcement time and resources rounding everybody up to listen to a profile.
Yeah.
And about how it's like, really, this hour it took. So we're talking like 30 people, took an hour to get everybody here. Then you did. So you're talking like 60, 70 man hours. Couldn't that have been better spent since none of these people will help you solve the crime? But this is actually the funniest example of that ever, because while they're in the middle of giving the profile, like, why are you giving a profile when you already know who the killer is? And B, while they're in the middle of giving the profile, they get a radio that the guy has been caught.
Yeah, I know. It was
it's so funny.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. But what does it cost to hire extras?
Oh, God. I mean, it's like $20 an hour. Yeah, it's not cheap.
Yeah, you could, but they need to give a profile. I mean, every episode has to give a profile.
Well, because how else are you going to explain to the audience, you know, what this guy's particular sexual dysfunction is? You could just have him explain it to the local cop. You don't need to do these scenes.
You explain to the local cop, tell the local cop what she has to do.
Yeah. Go from there.
And she just sends out her troops.
Dream, yeah. But always they do the big presentation to make sure these guys are the focus of everyone's attention. And it's funny because, again,
a little narcissistic, isn't it?
Why? Oh, of course it is. But the funny part is, it's like, why are you giving a profile if you already have a name and photograph and car information of the guy you're looking for? Why are you bothering?
Just, Oh, yeah, I know. Weird. But it, consistency was never, as I said, Virgil Williams has done the odd really good episode. And then he just, I don't know. It's like everything else with this show. I think they all stopped caring.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's really funny, though, when I watch it, and it's just weird, right? Where I'm watching the episode is I don't understand, like, and they want him to be, I don't understand why Daniel, like, Roebuck, they have to try and, like, I don't understand his character's motivation. I'll explain to you what I'm talking about. Because I know they want him to be a dirtbag, and they want the team to figure out where the missing girls are, right? They want that to happen, and I get that. But my issue with that whole scene is, and that whole, like, that whole process is, I don't understand his, like, motivation to back out of the deal. Because they're like, oh, they've turned Violet against me, so I'm going to back out of the deal. But the problem is, right, if he knows that the two little girls that he has left to die of thirst, right, he knows that they are in a room that is easily traceable to him. Literally, you just have to go, like, because he has set up shop in the home of an elderly person who he did handyman work for, who then died, and he just took over their house. And the girls are in another place where he did that. So literally, he knows that since they have his book of all of his clients, those girls are going to be found within 24 hours, right? So his only maneuver, and whether they're alive or dead, they're being found. And if they're dead, he's going to get charged with much worse crimes. So I don't understand why he doesn't take the deal, especially because if he takes the deal and tells them where the girls are, then it gives the mother more of a reason to shoot him at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And it's like they're so desperate to make the team fix everything, solve everything, be infallible, that they're like, no, just let the characters make the deal and understand that it's a compromise and understand that it's horrible. And that drives the mother so nuts. If you want to get to the ending of her shooting him,
yeah,
having them take the deal and rescue the girls is a better way to get there.
Yeah, because her daughter wasn't rescued.
Exactly. And now he's going to get away with it X amount of, like, he's only going to do 10 years in minimum security. She's been driven mad. She kills him.
Yeah.
I get that. But
that you understand.
Yeah.
I know.
But the fact that they also have them blow up the deal for no reason and have the team find it and them anyway really easily, like, they ruin what could have been a relatively strong end of the episode.
Well, isn't that part of their brand?
Okay, yeah, you got me there.
Look, I've been thinking about when we get around to doing these three episodes. Actually, made me think of this, because we're going to have to do, when we get around to the end again.
Yeah,
will have to do, I think, a separate episode that's just our overarching understanding of criminal minds, right?
Yeah.
And if one of the things is, they will ruin episodes,
yeah,
with bad endings all the time because they are so narcissistic.
Yeah. You know?
It's like, you know, why is Hotch so upset about giving him a deal? It's not like they haven't given other people deals. It's not like they haven't let people off the hook completely.
Yep.
At times. Now, they would never have left this guy off completely.
No, of course not. No, no, no.
And who's to say 10 years? He just said he didn't want life. He didn't want to spend the rest
of his life. No, I'm saying 10 years because, he's kidnapped and keep
the one girl died, right?
You're right. One girl died. So it might have been 25 years.
Yeah, he might get 25 years. But he wasn't going to get the minimum security. So.
And it's still minimum security. And it would still have been a comparatively comfortable life compared to what this man deserves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is America, and this would be in the South. So what he deserves is a hanging.
Yeah.
I'm not going to debate
you. I'm against the death penalty. I'm not going to argue with you on that front.
You know, I mean, that's what he deserves. But
absolutely.
You know,
Yeah, but that's not the show. But and it's like
that's not, and the show doesn't even go there. Like there's a whole stack of
stuff they could address that they just don't.
Because it is very nice when they find the girls, except that the girls are far too sane.
Yeah. They're weirdly well put together for girls who only have human contact
once a week.
Yeah, like, it's basically Casper Hauser, except they're not chained to the floor. How do they have such good social skills? How are they so good at reading?
You know?
It's kind of crazy, right?
No, I'm going, wow.
They are weirdly well put together.
Yes, and the little girl, it's only a problem because she hasn't had any water. I don't understand, though. So he leaves them water and food just enough once a week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then he comes back every week.
How can they be so healthy? Because what?
No, I mean, I agree with you.
Like, I'm sitting here going, and what was it like when they were babies?
Well, that's a really good question.
No, I'm sitting here going,
I don't know how Rose doesn't know, like, I can't believe, I mean, I know Rose always misbehaved, but the thing is, she had to have been there, like, they're not that far in age when at least one of those girls were born, because she was kidnapped, think about it, the little girl was kidnapped, the foster girl, Rose, was kidnapped when she was 8, or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? And by this older girl. And those little girls are like 8 now. Right?
Well, one of them is 8, the other one's younger.
Yeah, the other one is like 6. Right? So, one of them is like, the other one is 6. So it's like, I feel like she has to have been there for at least the 6-year-old's birth. Doesn't she?
You would think.
Yeah, it's like, it's just, it the way the episode talks about these characters.
Well, no, that's because
I feel like she would have had to have been there for the birth of at least one of these little girls, and she should have already known about the missing girls. And that they were going off and taking her. Also, it's like, bring up more that he took Violet with him for a weekend every single week.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Like, because she's going off to see her kids fairly regularly.
Once a week. You could think she never told anybody anything.
She never, like, it never, because you got to remember, he's going off to work, what do you call it, X amount of hours every day, right? And he's going off to work X amount of hours every day. He is not spending his whole day with them. They're not they're not trapped with him all the time. They're spending all of their time together.
Yeah.
These three women.
Girls, yeah.
Right, these three teenagers. They'll grow, all right. And she never once mentioned, oh, by the way,
I've got
two sisters who are locked up in a house somewhere. Like, that never came up in the 8 years they've all been living together?
I know. You would think, so possible. She was that afraid?
I just can't believe it wouldn't come up at all. Right? Okay.
I'm with you. Like, I can't believe that she wouldn't have told. These are her.
Yeah. Her cellmates, essentially.
Yeah.
These are her cellmates. She spends 24 hours a day with these other girls, right? Except when she's off with her daughters. How has this never come up
in the years they've been pregnant again? Or is he sleeping with the younger ones?
I don't know how that works.
Oh,
We are not getting into that.
No, he must be, because the one who died.
Yeah, was pregnant. She had a miscarriage.
And that's why she died.
And then she had an infection. Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, I mean, he's raping all of these girls. That's not even a question. We're not getting into the math of it, but that's just part of the episode. But the thing that I can't buy is that they wouldn't be talking.
Yeah, and I can't. Yeah, and that's it. I mean, and I'm just going, boy, that the one who got away,
yeah,
who escaped, who never forgot her identity, right? Yeah. I'm sitting there going, boy, she must have been one tough cookie, even at 8.
Oh, I know.
You know,
she was in the foster system. She's ready for this.
Yeah,
like she has survived the foster system for a couple of years already. So
at least, yeah,
She saw this guy coming.
She has no family left.
Nope.
Or anything.
I'm sorry. Every time we start talking about this character, it pisses me off so much.
Yeah, they just forget treated. About it. Like, what's gonna happen? Like, all I can
what's gonna
about
happen
is, what's
to this girl
to her now?
Like, she's got zero family. I mean, hopefully. I mean, this is best case scenario. Somebody makes a TV movie about her, and she gets to go have a ghost written book about her experiences. Makes a couple of bucks that way.
Yeah.
That is the best case scenario for this woman, right? Especially since she's the one who escaped and saved everybody.
Yeah, and she's yes. We can only we're going to give her a reasonably happy ending.
That the show it's again, it's not even that the show doesn't give her the happy ending that we feel she deserves. She gets no resolution of any kind. No. She disappears from the episode
basically
the minute the show finds a younger victim. To be obsessed with. The minute there are younger girls, right?
And besides, the one who is so sick, and Jasmine thinks that her sister is dead,
yeah,
right? Well, you know she's not dead because we've already seen her talk.
Exactly. Like, we know she's fine.
Yeah, we know she's fine.
There.
Is surprisingly fine, surprisingly quick.
Well, yes. Because, for a girl that should be hideously malnourished.
You know, and no water, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
You say what?
Oh, yeah, no. You're absolutely right to be questioning the logic of this. But yeah, this episode, more than so many others, just leaves a bad taste in my mouth solely because of its treatment of that one character. Like, if this character it's as much her Rose's story as it is Violet's.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it really is. She's a wonderful hero, and the show completely abuses her.
Disregards her. And abuses
her, disrespects her, and then throws her away. That's going to happen again, and it's going to be much worse. But remember this tendency when we start talking about season 13 and 14. Just remember that.
Yeah, I know. I tell you.
You know what's coming. You know what's coming. You've seen the episodes. All right, so let's move on to the next one.
Yeah, but remember, I have short-term memory loss. At least about Criminal Minds.
Yeah. Well, this one is the one that's not forgettable. All right, go for it.
None of these. So, I mean, this year, too, I'm still. But then Hotch is still in it, right?
Yeah.
Now we're going to do. Oh, God help me. This was the worst of the three episodes. A Badge and a Gun.
I think it is, yeah. Go.
The BAU returns to Los Angeles, California one more time. They really like Los Angeles.
I wonder why.
After three, the budget is getting
exactly better. Cheaper to film.
Yeah. After three women are killed by asphyxiation in their homes and the local field office unearths surveillance footage that makes them suspect the killer is one of their own. Meanwhile, Morgan suspects Savannah wants to end their relationship after receiving a cryptic text.
Yeah. Of course, we know she's really pregnant because we've seen television before.
Even the first time around, you knew she was
pregnant. Oh, right away. Come on. Yeah. Not for one second did we not think she was pregnant. Come on. All right. So I'm just going to say that right off, there's something important to know about this episode. And that is, it can't happen. And it could happen if they rewrote it, and they wouldn't have to rewrite it much, but these are very inept people who don't care about their jobs. And this is just a fact, when an FBI agent retires, right, you do get to keep your badge. But they take the badge, and there is a hole punch press, and it essentially stamps the word retired through the badge, completely damaging the badge. So it cannot be used as ID in any way, shape, or form. Right? At all. It full on cannot. So it's like, you can't have a real FBI badge. That said, and this is what's so weird about the episode, there's no need for this guy to have a real FBI badge. Do you think the average person in the average building knows what an FBI badge looks like? Do you know what an FBI badge looks like?
Well, yes, because Steve had one. I mean, the professional
head. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but that's a whole other conversation. But yes, we did a short film about the FBI, is the point she's making. But yeah, what it comes down to is there's a joke thing about the FBI. Right, but yes, you know, but most people don't know what an FBI badge looks like. And it's weird that it's like the episode requires him to have this FBI badge, but I'm like, but for everything he does in the episode, it didn't, like, the episode doesn't need him to have a real FBI badge. Like, nothing has changed in the episode if he's just a guy with a fake badge. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how would the episode be in any way different? Not at all. So you would give away, like, the biggest unrealistic part of the episode, that they don't let you keep a badge when you retire from the FBI. Right? That's the most unrealistic part. And nothing else about the episode changes. Because I want to stress, there are two absolutely ludicrous things in this episode. One, the badge, the badge gets him to, the badge gets him identifiable, right? That is completely real, that he could never have. Two, the way they find the retired FBI agent is the craziest, dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life, which is he shoots an undercover cop. And as that undercover cop is in the process of falling over and lying in the street with four bullets in his bulletproof vest, winded, all that, he sees, sitting in the back window of a man's car 50 feet away at night, the specific design of a baseball cap. What? Are you kidding me?
No, I wish I could say yes.
No, no, you can't do this show. You just can't.
Oh, yes, they can. Oh, yes, they can.
But the crazy part is, like, the killer is driving his own car. If you told me that cop got the guy's license plate, that would be fine. I would completely believe that this cop would have the wherewithal to read a license plate. But the FBI cap in the back window of a car speeding away while you're lying on the ground? Hey, here's a hint. Here's something fun for you to try. Just lie on your side. Find a light, you know, really clean patch of sidewalk, and just lie on your side. Now try looking into the back window of a car. You'll find that from that angle, it's physically impossible.
And you know because you tried.
I did. Well, I didn't have to try. I'm not an idiot, and I understand how physics works. Just like this episode. And they only find him because they find out what the guy is, and then they put out an APB for him and his car, and then they just get him. But, like, whether or not they knew the guy's name, they had a description of his car and his APB. So, like, the whole thing at the end where they find the FBI agent's body and find out the guy's actual name and his motive for crushing women, that's not relevant to how they catch him. Although it is relevant because it allows JJ to talk to him about the way he was sexually humiliated as a child that makes him angry and want to put down a gun. So there you go. And attack her instead of, it makes him so angry that he tries to attack them instead of using the hostage. Although that puzzled me too, because he like kind of drops the hostage when he pulls the gun away. And I'm like, yeah, you're mad. You want to shoot them, but they're still pointing guns at you, dude. Do you not see the value of still having a hostage? You confuse me, buddy.
Well, but he had decomposed.
He has decompensated to the point.
He's decompensated to the point that he can't make logical sense of things. How's that?
Absolutely. And it actually
absolutely it
raises the question, and this is what puzzled me about the episode. So are we, like, meant to believe? Because his plan was, like, go to a place where there had been a murder, right? Or a rape or something. Pretend to be an FBI agent.
Yep.
And I love that nobody is like, why is the FBI looking into a murder?
Mm-hmm.
That's not your job, the FBI. But I guess in real life, people don't know a lot about the FBI. So there you go. I mean, people in real life don't know that the FBI never go anywhere alone. for example, apparently, because that's a fun fact. FBI, like, they always go in pairs places. You're never going to see, like, a single FBI agent anywhere, just as a general rule. But anyway, when I'm watching
they're
the
like
episode,
Mormons.
Well, that's what that joke was about in that episode that didn't work at all.
Yeah,
is that they're like Mormons.
They weren't dressed like they
because they weren't dressed like FBI agents. It's weird how, like, now that we're 11 seasons in, I've just stopped mentioning how unprofessionally all these people, except for Aaron, dress.
Yeah.
Like, every single one of them is not dressed for the job they have, except for Aaron.
Yeah, and the only one who has an excuse for not dressing professionally is Garcia, because she's the techie.
She doesn't go out in public.
Techies don't have to.
No, techies don't have to do that.
You know, techies dress like techies.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, have I once complained about how she dresses? No, never. But no, it's weird to me, right? That it's like, that never, like, I don't even think about it anymore, right? But, like, it's funny because you see this guy, I've got to be taken seriously an FBI agent, so he actually puts on the full FBI costume.
Yep.
Because even a serial killer gets that FBI agents have to dress a certain way to be taken seriously. I mean, he doesn't know to not wear running shoes, but that's a whole other conversation. I don't think most people ever look at people's shoes in their day-to-day lives. But the thing that I was so confused about when I was watching the episode, like, are we meant to believe that, like, so he went in to attack women by pretending there was a to be canvassing for a thing. Not something FBI agents do, but that's not the point. People don't know. My question is this, exactly, but... So, miraculously, is the first door he knocked on each time
a woman who was
alone in her apartment and ready to get murdered?
That's what I couldn't figure out.
Like, because I feel like after the first murder, other people would remember the FBI agent canvassing in the building.
Yeah, well, I was just, you know, you keep hoping for that because that would make sense.
Yeah. But in no case does anyone seem to notice that there was an FBI agent in the area canvassing. And it's like, how could you not, like, how could he get the exact target of his rage every single time the first time? Like, it beggars belief. And the weird part is, and this is one of those things where the need to have the team figure everything out on their own, basically, kind of, like, makes things less believable, because it's not a worse episode if they know right away that there's a guy running around with a badge and a gun pretending to be a cop and killing women. Because that alone is a terrifying situation, because how can the women in this town now trust the cops who are supposed to be protecting them?
Mm-hmm.
Like, even without there being a mystery about how he's doing it, for the team, it's still a really difficult solve and a hard thing for them to catch. And setting up a, like, figuring how he does it and setting up the trap. But it's like this extra thing where they have to also figure out that he's pretending to be an FBI agent to make them look good makes the episode that much less plausible, because you have to imagine that every time the first doorbell he rang, oh, okay, well, this is the woman I'm going to kill today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just not that believable. And it's very frustrating, because it's, I was about to say, because it ruins an otherwise, no, it doesn't ruin an otherwise.
No. if it only did.
Yeah, right.
If it only did.
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, as I was watching this episode, I couldn't help but think about, so I was reading, I don't remember which site it was, but it was like a Farewell to Criminal Minds, right? Uh-huh. And in it, it talked about Mandy Patinkin's, right, his, what do you call it, in his hatred for the show, right? How not only did he leave, but he left in a really vocal way talking about how awful the show was, right?
Yep.
He was not subtle about his feelings towards Criminal Minds at all. And what got me when I was watching this, when I was reading this article, was that the lukewarm defense that the person writing the article tried to offer, because he specifically called out, it's like the psychological damage done to me, like telling the story of these women getting raped and murdered every single week, it just got to be too much.
Yeah.
Right.
That's all he said.
That's what he said. And it's like, yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it gets to be too much for us sometimes, the biggest fans of Criminal Minds there are. Right? Like, it gets to be too much for us, too. Like, I can get why he felt that way. But then it's like, the person naively responded, I think he was being a little hyperbolically. It's always been an equal opportunity with show with plenty of men getting killed. And I'm like, have you never watched the show? I feel like maybe you've never seen an episode of Criminal Minds. From time to time, men get killed on the show, but that is not the show's bread and butter.
No.
That is not the water in which the show swims. You know?
Not at all.
And that's what's so crazy about this guy's response, where he's like, no, that's just, there is this, and I don't know why this episode, more than the previous episode, about little girls who are raised to be sex slaves.
Yeah.
For some reason, this episode about a man just walking around Los Angeles suffocating women triggered my revulsion for that kind of storytelling more than the previous episode did. Probably because the previous episode I was concerned about little girls getting saved and I was sickened by their treatment of the survivor. Yeah. I was too distracted. But in this episode, you've just got so much focus on the terror and the agonizing deaths of these women. You know?
The second time you watched it. Half the time, I'm closing my eyes for those scenes. I'm just going, how can you do this?
Every week. Yeah. You know? But it's like, I'm glad you're with me on this one. This one, I just found especially vile.
Oh, it was just terrible. Like when he started to rip down the shower curtain, that's it. I'm getting up. I'm going to go get my coffee.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I was worried I was being a bit too sensitive.
My coffee is finished brewing. I heard it go off, so I'm going to go get my coffee.
And you'll come back when the murder scene's over. I have been too sensitive to this stuff in the past, and I will admit I've been too sensitive to this stuff in the past. But this one, for some reason, especially because, like, the killer is such a non-entity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, there's nothing to him. And when you get his motivation, that he was like, some mean girls, tricked him and got him to be trapped in some gym mats when he was in high school? Like, what? You know? Like, that's why all of this is happening? Where they try to put this, well, one bad thing happened to him when he was a teenager, and now all of these women are dying agonizing deaths. I'm like, it's more complicated than that, buddy. Like, maybe he also was abused for a huge amount as a child. I'm sure prison was rough on him, but it's like, the fact that they try to, hey, while we're, you know, we've shown all of these women dying agonizing deaths. Now, let's take a moment to talk about where this guy's specific fetish comes from.
Yeah, well, we have to, no, you've caught him. It doesn't matter anymore.
It doesn't matter his fetish comes from.
Not anymore. If you hadn't caught him and you were trying to understand what he was doing.
And why. And blah, blah, blah. Sure. But for it to just be, no, let's just give you a little side note about someone's fetish. And I'm like, what? Out of nowhere? And I'm not saying this episode was written by someone, who that happened to, and it is their fetish. I am in no way saying that. I'm saying it's definitely a fetish that came up during their research. The thing, and it's like, oh, well, I just want to talk about this fetish. Like, okay. Weird thing to bring up in an episode is all I'm saying about that. Weird thing to bring up. Again, it's just this episode, you're right, it's the worst one because it's kind of dumb, but it's the worst one because even for Criminal Minds, I found this one weirdly unpleasant. You know, weirdly bleak and weirdly awful and just weirdly dire. Even for Criminal Minds.
I wonder, you know, in some ways, it's really weird, sort of. Sorry for using the same word.
It's okay.
But it's almost as if the actor who played the murderer
yeah
makes it more even more so.
He's so intense, and he has such a visible contempt for the people he's murdering.
And the actor is doing a really good job of being so open and pleasant.
Yeah.
And then gets inside.
And then gets twitchy, and then now he's just full of hatred.
But it's that they set it up, and I'm not sure, because you can't sort of set that up necessarily in the script. So he would have added sort of this little bit of stuff to his role. And he does a really good job of being a just perfectly creepy.
Oh, he's very creepy.
Guy. And right across the board, you know. And it just made it just, yeah, it was just.
Yeah, it's even, I know it's for this show's standards, right? And that's what I'm saying. Even by this show's standards, this is an unusually unpleasant episode, right?
Yeah.
I know that's a high bar, right? But see what I'm saying?
No, I mean, it was unpleasant for a whole stack of things. And one of them is that they don't, I mean, they didn't bother giving us, sometimes you just go, there is stuff they just add that's unnecessary.
Exactly.
It ruins, I tell you, the biggest thing that I'm going to say after Ed Brunero left is they friggin' ruin the episodes with their lousy endings every time.
Yeah.
And this is...
They really have forgotten how to end episodes.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
And talk about bizarre quotes. And bizarre music in these ones. I was
it was
holy,
weird.
What are you guys doing? Okay, there's nobody in charge, clearly.
No.
And as I said, and Jim Clemente, of course, wrote A Badge and a Gun.
Seriously?
The writer.
Jim Clemente wrote this one.
Yep.
I don't get you, world.
No, well, because, and it goes always back to this idea. If this was set in La La Land, okay. In La La Land, the world, an alternate universe, the worlds are different. Sometimes they say it has to be set in an alternate universe because they insist, right? Somehow or another. If you listen to the commentaries, even now, right? it's just like, no, we're really showing how this is, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, really?
No.
Really? Okay, now let's get to the end of this one.
Yeah, no, it's... All right, so let's get to the end.
At the end of the episode...
Yeah, it's just frustrating. At the end of the episode, we realize that... and by the way, it's like... It's weird, because Savannah... I was about to say his behavior to Savannah is a little strange, but it's completely in character. Because the thing is, you get called away, because she's like, we've got to talk. And you get called away, and that's, it's freaky, then, because you wonder what's going on with her. But, like, someone in a mature relationship could take either of it, like, could, during his five-hour plane ride, get on the phone with his girlfriend, and just based on the tone of her voice, get a sense of what's going on. But Derek is the kind of guy who hides from confrontation whenever possible, and ghosts women until they break up with him. So this is not off brand for the man at all. You know, that's just who he is. So yeah, I'm not gonna say this isn't realistic. It is disappointing from him. You live with this woman. You've moved in together. I will always say that key you gave her should have come with a wedding ring. An engagement ring, but that's another conversation.
She had to get knocked out first.
No, yeah, she had to get knocked up before Derek would marry her. God damn it, Derek. When I'm watching the episode, I'm like, obviously we know what's going on. But, it is weird that he, takes no steps no steps whatsoever to find out what's going on. He just lets himself stew in the thing for a couple of days while he's gone. Like, come on, Derek, grow up.
Yeah, well.
You just want the man to grow up.
Yeah. Well, okay. And my only problem, okay, is that, okay, so it gets this happy ending, and then he's going, and then the guy bumps into him, and blah.
And you're like, uh-oh.
But he's talking, okay, he's talking to Savannah.
Yeah.
And I just don't, he just says to her, call Hotch. And
yeah.
She keeps talking to him.
Yep.
And I'm going, like,
girl, do you not understand the situation here?
Girl. You already know there's something wrong, and all he's saying is, call Hotch. Why didn't you hang up and phone
Hang
Hotch?
Up and do it.
Instead of, you wasted 30 seconds, a minute, I don't know how long.
Every minute you're not calling Hotch and getting Garcia to find out exactly where his phone is putting Derek's life in greater danger. Like, if this man says, you know, there's a problem, call Hotch, do it. Do it right away.
Call Hotch. It's not like she doesn't know what he does for a living.
Exactly. He's got a dangerous job. Jeez. Yeah, it's kind of weird. And this, of course, is all setting up next week's big Derek-themed episode, which is about let's segue him, segue him off the show because he's leaving. And, well, that episode
has
its own...
But it is nice to see Danny Glover.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we get there. Speaking of, what's the homework for next week?
Okay, everybody's got to watch 16, 17, and 18, and that is Derek. And then The Sandman. And then A Beautiful Disaster.
You know...
And we get to see Lance Henriksen, so...
I know, it is. It is. You know. He's perfect. I love
and
Lance
Matthew,
Henriksen.
You know, Greg Goobler does, you know, direct it.
He directed the episode. What do you call it?
A Beautiful Disaster.
Yeah, he directs A Beautiful Disaster. We'll talk about him as a director next week. We're not going to get into that now.
Joe.
But what I will say, though, is that it's a weird way to get him off the show, is what I'm going to say about that.
Ahead. Okay, and no more.
No more. We're saving it for next week.
Otherwise,
absolutely, we're saving it for next
week.
You're right. I'm going to start getting into it now. Yeah.
You repeat yourself.
I know, exactly. And I don't want to do that. I apologize. We're not going to spoil all of our fun today. No. Anyway, but yes, this week it just ends on such a dispiriting note. It just makes you like, say, why do you have to do this, Criminal Minds? You don't have to be this way. You could be doing better than you're doing.
Yes, except it's Criminal Minds.
Except it's Criminal Minds. And yeah, and that's the weird part with, like, Jim Clemente is a retired FBI agent. Yeah. He knows that he doesn't have...
A badge that you can use.
A badge that you can use. He knows that. Yeah. You know? Like, and I mean, the thing is, one of the scariest things, and that's what this is bears down to. It's like, literally, this comes from his, what do you call it? And this is, I think, where we're going to come back to Pride before we go. Because you were talking about how they have to present the FBI and blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that it's like a badge and a gun. This whole episode is based on, it's like, what is the difference between, you know, an FBI agent and a mobster, and that is, he's got a or like any citizen, but specifically a mobster, is he's got a badge, and a regular person's got a badge and a gun. Like, they're not special. They have just been authorized to do violence for the state, and that's why the badge is scary and drilled into them from the moment they start joining any police department. Right, they are told your badge is sacred. Mm-hmm. Right. You cannot, under any circumstances, lose your badge or your gun. Like, you cannot have it be... that is the worst thing that can happen to a cop. And that is a fear that, like, all cops live with every day. What if a bad guy got a hold of my badge? Because fundamentally, the difference between you and a gangster is that the state says you can do what you do. Right? The state, like, if I point a gun at you and say, you've got to stay here, I'm committing a crime. If a cop does it, that's his job. And it's only the badge that makes the difference. And so, at their core, the cops are told, you've got to protect it above all else. And so the scariest thing for them is, what if I lost my badge? And instead of making the episode about that, they have this, like, about what if an FBI agent got killed and his badge got taken, and they started doing that. But they try to lessen it down by having it be a retired FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, think of how much more realistic and dramatic an episode it is if an FBI agent has been killed and now someone is going around the city using their badge to commit these horrific crimes, and it's a race against time to catch this guy. But no, they have to have that extra level where also they have to figure out whose badge it is and blah, 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 blah. And by doing that, you kind of kill the episode. You lose all the realism. You take away the part that Jim Clemente, the fear that he really lived with when he was an FBI agent. Like, you take everything real out of the episode by that one decision, by pretending you don't understand how retired FBI agents and their badges work. So yeah, that one stuck with me.
Except now, yeah. I think I want to go watch Magnolia.
Oh, because he loses his gun.
He lost his badge and his gun. It was a
He doesn't lose his badge. He just loses his gun. But yeah, it's like that might be his whole career.
Yes.
Like a cop losing his gun, he might not be a cop anymore.
Yes, but at all.
Oh my God. By the way.
Magnolia.
Oh, Magnolia is perfect.
Oh.
But I mean, I'm not saying they should have. Now I'm just writing my own episode. I'm not saying they should have done what I'm about to say. But imagine an episode where an FBI agent has lost his badge and he knows the huge consequences of that. So he tries to hide the fact that he's lost his badge. And he's trying to find the guy without involving the cops because he knows it's his career.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode happens. So there's a guy running around murdering people, and he's got a real FBI badge because it was taken from a real FBI agent. But the FBI agent didn't tell anyone his badge was stolen because he's trying to shut it down himself to keep it from having anything bad happen to his career.
Hey.
Now that's an episode.
There's a movie.
There's a movie in that. Like, just the idea of, like, him knowing the consequences of his badge getting taken from him. And it's, like, this thing where he's trying to cover it up and trying to keep... Because, fundamentally, what he values is more his own career and station than the damage is being done by this guy pretending to be an FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the episode I just pitched would be very critical about people in the FBI. And that is something that they could not afford to make. So my dream episode, I mean, it is just that, a dream. It could never happen. But yeah, maybe that's a movie we'll write. We'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's your homework for next week. Sorry for going on another 5 minutes about the badge, but that part just occurred to me.
And watch Magnolia as well.
Oh, Magnolia is so good.
All those
you
people
have
who
to watch
never
Magnolia.
Watched, even if once you watch the opening sequence, if you're not hooked.
How can you? Yeah. It's like, how can you stop that movie after you watch the first 5 minutes of Magnolia?
Yeah. Okay. So.
All right. Go. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions for us, if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions for profiling related fiction you think we should check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you were listening to this on any kind of a podcatching client, be sure to give us a rating and try not to base that rating on how badly I've garbled all of the words for this last minute. Please base it on the rest of the episode.
Well, you've had a rough week.
I've had a very rough week. And I will not talk about that in our next episode. See you there. But until then, au revoir.
Have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.